Affairs today, June 24, 2003, and colleagues, today we are basically just going to be doing a public hearing on Senate Bill 102. This bill has come through from on the Senate side with some I guess a different way on how to deal with ballot titles and the initiatives. And through the time that it's been on the House side, I have met with different folks, both the proponents of Senate Bill 102 and those who had concerns with it, to see if there might be another way to deal with this issue. And that is the initial stab at it, and truly I'm saying really why we're dealing with this on a public hearing level at this point is that, you know, we do understand, I think, that there's still some work to be done beyond the Dash A7s that were presented to you only a couple hours ago. I want to thank the Legislative Council. It's been kind of an arduous task to go through the different issues that are presented in these amendments, and you know where we thought we might have these completed earlier to give you a little bit more time for review before today's public hearing. It's just the function of time that we were only able to get them out of LC just a couple hours ago. And same for those who are in our audience today. There's a lot to digest here. I will just kind of look at a few of the key principles that went in these amendments, and then there's some other folks I think that are here that can help talk about it as well. The Senate Bill 102, as it came over from the Senate chamber, basically in an effort to, I think, raise the bar on you know what it would take to get a ballot title for the initiative process, an issue petition. It was determined by the Senate to basically come up with a signature level of 10% that would be required to get the to first get that ballot title and get it going for getting signatures. The what I was looking at is you know, although I agree that it makes sense to allow the I think those who are interested in an initiative petition to show that they need to do more than just gain the 25 signatures that are currently provided by law. I don't know that the 10% level, you know, was the appropriate number, and I looked at trying to get some work done on that. What you'll see before you is a proposal in the amendment that will actually reduce that number down instead of being 10%. And there are others who can correct me on the exact numbers, but 10% of a constitutional amendment is approximately 10,000 signatures, and 10% of a statutory amendment is about 8,500 signatures. And instead of doing that, you know, still raise the bar a bit, but raise it up to about 1,500 signatures in this proposal. It also made the proposal set up so that those signatures would be considered verified, or they would have to be verified, which then could be counted towards the ultimate signature count for petitions. And the concept then goes on that if there is a once they reach that amount, then the ballot title drafting would go to the Legislative Council Committee, and our Legislative Council would draft the ballot title. There is a, I think the provision is set up. No? That was, okay. We'll get a clarification on that. There is, Legislative Council has the responsibility, instead of the Attorney General. After After that point, then if there is opposition to what the ballot title reads, then the appeal would go to a three-judge panel of senior judges, folks, they're, lack of a better term, they're called Plan B judges, retired judges who have who qualify for a different pension plan based on them putting time back into the court system, working a certain number of hours. Those are our Plan B judges, and I think we have, from what I understand, about 24, 26 Plan B judges right now. Finding a way to then use these so that you can get a three-judge panel that can do the review, make a quick decision on these ballot titles so that the people can move on to their respective initiative gathering or signature gathering process. And then saying that that three-judge panel is their last appeal, that there would be no further appeals to the Supreme Court. So that's kind of the concept that I threw out through to some different folks. We got different reactions from people. And, you know, the purpose today is to you know, give some folks, give you all a time, some time to review the proposal, hear from the folks on their issues of concern or support, and then we can decide through that process, you know, where we're going to take this whole issue. So to start it out, I think I'd like to call Ross Day forward. And I'd use some of Ross's legal expertise just to, and his experience in the initial process just to help draft some of the language before it went to Legislative Council.
Wow, legal expertise. I didn't know I had that, but I appreciate it.
And I will let you, sir, go ahead and, you know, comment on this and take it as you choose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Ross Day, Oregonians in Action. I apologize, first of all, for my informal attire. I was working on a brief in at the office and was called down on my cohort was supposed to be down here. Mr. Honeycutt got called away on a family emergency, and so I'm here, and I apologize if I'm not as prepared as I normally would be to comment not only on Senate Bill 102, but also the A7 amendments that you have there, which I did a substantial amount of the work on. Let me just say about Senate Bill 102A, the actual measure that's before you, that measure Oregonians in Action is strongly opposed to. I don't want to sugarcoat anything, so I'll just tell you, it kills the initiative process for grassroots organizations such as Oregonians in Action and other groups. Not just conservative groups, but liberal groups, moderate groups, and everyone in between. Basically, what it does is, with the 10% signature requirement, the only people who will be able to afford to participate in the initiative process are those who have big dollars. And that's not Oregonians in Action, and that's not some of the other grassroots groups that are out there. We don't have the kind of money it would take to put a measure on the ballot. And the reason why is, the key, it's generally accepted in initiative circles, that the key to a successful ballot measure campaign is the ballot title. That's just the way it is. Whether we like it or not, generally speaking, that's all the voters read, is the ballot title, and that's what makes or breaks the success of a measure. And the problem is the reason why this ballot title shopping is presumed to be such a prevalent problem is because when you submit a ballot title under the current process to the Attorney General's office, you get a terrible ballot title in return. Let me give an example. This bill couldn't have come up during a better session because 2 years ago, Oregonians in Action submitted a ballot measure and litigated the ballot title all the way through to the Supreme Court, was modified by the Supreme Court and certified by the Supreme Court regarding it had to do with the property owner notification measure. We submitted that exact same, verbatim, the exact same ballot measure, Then I don't think we changed a single period, comma, quotation mark, anything. And we got an entirely different ballot title from the Attorney General's office. Obviously, one that we did not support, one that was a terrible ballot title, and would have sank the ballot measure. That just, for me, just blew me away. This has been litigated. We've got case law on this particular ballot measure. So what does that mean? Well, it means that we've got to rewrite our ballot measure and resubmit it and turn around and go through that whole rigmarole again until we finally get a ballot title that is somewhat even close to what we litigated 3 years ago. The problem here with ballot title shopping isn't the people using the initiative process, it's how the ballot titles are drafted. That's the problem that I think we really need to address. The threshold of at what point you get a ballot measure, I think, is irrelevant. I think if you fix how the ballot titles are drafted, I don't think you have the perceived problem of ballot title shopping. There are other groups that I'm aware of, and I'll let their representatives come and speak, who've had the same thing happen to them. Well, they submitted a ballot measure and got a ballot title that doesn't describe what the ballot, they wonder, what is this ballot title referring to? Because it's not the measure that we submitted. So that's the problem that we have. And unfortunately, Senate Bill 102, what it does instead is it says, before you even get a ballot title, you've got to collect 10% of the required signatures to qualify the measure for the ballot. What that does is you've got to go out and collect those signatures with a measure summary that's drafted by the Attorney General. You've got to go out and collect those signatures and hope that you get a ballot title that is at least fair. Now imagine if we'd have taken our 10% measure, which we're obviously not moving forward with right now because of the ballot title we got, and we'd have gone out and spent all that money on getting the signatures, and we turn it in, submit the ballot measure to the Attorney General, we end up getting the ballot measure we just wasted all that money. Well, groups like Oregonians in Action and other groups I'm aware of don't have that kind of money. And so basically we're given the option. Now for some of you that might be a good thing. You may not like to see Oregonians in Action have any measures on the ballot. And you know what? There are probably some groups that others of you don't want to see have measures on the ballot. But that's not your choice. That's not anyone in this room's choice. The Constitution guarantees us all a right to access the initiative process. And I think it's wholly improper for anybody, let alone the legislature, to place impediments to that. I mean, imagine if you had to go out and get 10% of required signatures, 10% of the total signatures equal to 10% of the total votes cast in the last gubernatorial election in order to have a protest in downtown Portland. How many in this room would approve of that?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not real happy that you're accusing me of not wanting...
I'm sorry. I apologize. Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, I don't mean to be pointing fingers. What I'm suggesting instead is that what this measure does is it necessarily excludes some of us from the initiative process. And my suggestion is if you had to get 10% of the votes, you know, signatures of the votes cast at the last gubernatorial election out of a protest, we'd have a revolt in this state. That's a right guaranteed by the Constitution. Well, why are we doing the same thing to another right? Why are we imposing this limitation on those of us who want to access the initiative process? So with that, we were given the opportunity, Mr. Honeycutt and I and others, were given the opportunity to draft amendments to Senate Bill 102 that I think get at the heart of the problem, while at the same time addressing a lot of the concerns, I think, of the proponents of Senate Bill 102A. The -A7 amendments are slightly different than the procedure that the chair spoke of earlier. What they do, and I don't have the amendments that cover the exact legislative council process that the chair mentioned. What they do is they do two substantial things that I think we need to talk about. I'll talk about the first thing they do is they take the ballot title writing process out of the Attorney General's office, which I think is a common theme between what the chair talked about and the A7 amendments, And what they do instead is, with a three-judge panel that's appointed by the Supreme Court, both proponents and opponents of any measure will have the opportunity to submit draft ballot titles to the three-judge panel. And what they would do is they'd file them with the Supreme Court, and then the Supreme Court would transmit those to the three-judge panel. And the three-judge panel could do one of two things. They could pick one of the ballot titles that's submitted, or they could not pick any of them, and the Secretary of State would then give proponents and opponents of a measure the opportunity once again to submit draft ballot titles. And you continue with that process until the three-judge panel picks a ballot title. Well, the first thing when we run this by people, they think, well, we don't want Oregonians in Action writing the ballot title for Measure 7. We're going to talk about how great it is and how it's going to save the state of Oregon and all those kinds of things. Well, if we were to write a ballot title like that for Measure 7 or for a Measure 7 type measure, there's no way that would get selected by the three-judge panel. And we run the risk of opponents of Measure 7 selecting the opponents of Measure 7's ballot title being selected instead. So the incentive is certainly on the proponents, and conversely, the opponents of the measure to draft impartial, unbiased ballot titles from which the three-judge panel can select. In fact, if you write a very biased or impartial ballot title in this process proposed by the A7 amendments, chances are your ballot title is not going to get selected. So that's basically the way the process would work until such time as a ballot title is selected. It would also require legislative council to submit a ballot title as well in this process. There are a couple of amendments we'd need to make to this process that I've had suggested to me that I think that would be good, such as blind submittal. In other words, you don't get to put groups' names or those sorts of things on the submitted ballot titles, and also require that the Secretary of State reformat the submittals and the arguments that would go to the three-judge panel. A three-judge panel would rotate in the A7 amendments every 6 months. No three-judge panel could serve consecutively, and not more than twice in any five-year period. I don't know exactly how that would work. I don't know that would work, because I don't know how many Plan B judges are out there, but I just took a stab in the dark and said this sounds pretty reasonable. Lastly, and probably most importantly for proponents of Senate Bill 102A, is the threshold for getting into this process, if you will, is raised to 1,500 verified signatures or $1,500. I understand that probably gives a lot of people heartburn. We would not object to making that $1,500 and $1,500. That's perfectly fine as well. Or if the committee wants to pick a higher number, of course, we'd be very concerned and reticent to accept a number of verified signatures or a dollar figure for that matter that's going to make it impossible for grassroots groups to, or for that matter, any individual citizen to go out and spend $1,500 and collect 1,500 signatures to get a measure, at least in the ballot, in the initiative process. That's in a nutshell what the A7s do. I know it's not the concept that the chair was discussing earlier, and I'd be happy to. I don't have my materials with me. Mr. Honeycutt does. I do have those amendments, but they're in my folder that Mr. Honeycutt has. But I'd be happy to get those to you too if you like. The second thing the A7s do is a concept that, as near as I can tell, is supported not only by Oregonians in Action, but by various legislators and the Secretary of State, and that is eliminates post-election procedural challenges, something that we discussed, that I testified before this committee a few months ago about, to adopted initiatives. This isn't a concept that just hatched out of my brain. This is something that the Supreme Court has asked on at least three separate occasions the legislature to address. What it does is it says that you have 60 days from the date that the Secretary of State makes a determination of procedural constitutionality, you have 60 days from that date to challenge that decision, and it's jurisdictional, meaning that the court, that you couldn't file such a challenge after after initiative, after the 60-day period has expired, and certainly after initiative is adopted by the people. That's it in a nutshell, what the A7s do. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. And Mr. Chair, if possible, if you need to, I can stick around and answer any questions that I have.
Okay. Representative Monis Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am curious as to why you would choose the Legislative Council over the Attorney General's office to do the work. The initiative process was set up to be the grassroots people's way of getting their opinion or their wants or desires out to the public for a vote, whereas the Legislative Council is the legislators' attorneys, and I would think that it would become much, much more political bringing it into the Legislative Council.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Moss Anderson, Article 4, Section 1 says that the legislative powers of the legislature, the legislative powers of the state are vested in not only the legislature but also the people through the initiative and referendum. So I'd suggest to you that the initiative process in and of itself in its entirety is a legislative process and not an executive process and certainly not a judicial process, thank God. And so to that extent, I think that it is entirely a legislative function and should remain in the legislature in some way, shape, or form. And so Legislative Council seems to be the most logical choice. Certainly Attorney General has a lot more experience. I understand that point, and that's a fine point. But I think that the initiative process is legislative in nature, it should remain in the legislative branch.
Okay, Paula?
But don't you think that so many of these initiatives that would come out are at the frustration that the legislature isn't doing their job, or at least not making laws to their liking, and this is the way the legislative or the initiative process has, because they're able to put forth ideas that the legislature obviously isn't doing.
Chair Doyle, Vice Chair Moss Anderson, certainly that is certainly the reason why many of us run initiatives out on the ballot is because of what we perceive to be inaction on the part of the legislature, but. Nevertheless, the A7s don't make Legislative Council the final arbiter. The Legislative Council's draft ballot title that's submitted to the three-judge panel under the A7s isn't the ballot title. It's one of presumably many that would be submitted. And if a proponent or opponent or any elector who submits a draft ballot title is wise and careful enough, it won't be Legislative Council's ballot title that gets adopted by the three-judge panel. It would be a citizens, presumably electors.
And just to follow up on that is, I guess is a suggestion that the initiative language is drafted by Legislative Council, or is it just the ballot title?
Mr. Chair, it's just the ballot title. It would not be the initiative language.
So it's the initiative language that becomes law after it's passed by the voters.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Other questions? Representative Bircher.
Yes. I would like to begin by saying that Thomas Jefferson says the people are always right even when they're wrong. And I have high respect for that, and I'm very offended by even the suggestion that I would not want any organization to have something on the ballot. My question to you is, what is your opinion of taking several ballot titles and polling them or running them through to see which one has the most public appeal?
Chair Doyle, Representative Berger, first of all, I apologize if I offended you. I certainly didn't mean to. But with regard to that issue, I think that's just one of those facts of life that I don't think we can stop. I don't think anybody's going to going to be able to stop that. If somebody, the bottom line is, even under Senate Bill 102A, if I've got enough money, I can go out and collect signatures for a myriad of different ballot titles or different ballot measures, take each one of the ballot titles that I get, and go out and poll it. The difference is, you've got to have a boatload of money in order to be able to do that. I don't know that's necessarily a bad thing. I don't think it's insidious in any way or undermines the electoral process. What I think it does is it represents the importance of the ballot title and why it is people are motivated to, quote-unquote, ballot title shop. Because ballot titles are important. And getting back to the example I cited earlier in my testimony, the instance where we have a ballot title that was litigated all the way to the Supreme Court and certified by the Supreme Court, we take the exact same ballot title or ballot measure, excuse me, and get an entirely different ballot ballot title. It just flabbergasts me, and it forces us into that position.
Okay.
Any further questions? Okay. Thank you. Let's see. How about Phil Schradl?
Good afternoon. Philip Schradl, Special Counsel to the Attorney General, for the record. Chair Doyle, thanks for starting this conversation. I'd like to take a few minutes to go over Senate Bill 102A as it came across from the Senate. I was actively involved in the bills that proceeded through the Senate side. And I'd like to give you just a very, very brief overview of that proposal and use that basically as a way to contrast the proposal that is presented to you at Dash A7. The general framework of the ballot title process in Senate Bill 102, as it passed through the Senate, was that a proposed initiative measure would be filed with the Secretary of State. Secretary of State provides statewide notice, and there's a 10-day comment period for people to comment on that, on the constitutional procedural issues that might be raised by the case. That is the second half of the Dash A7 proposal that you have in front of you, with a little bit of difference. There's a 10-day period for the Secretary of State to make a decision on the constitutional procedural compliance issues. And then, and only then, is if the Secretary of State approves it for signature gathering, does it go out for signature gathering. And then the first 10 to 15% of the signatures are gathered simply with a copy of the proposed measure attached. And once 10 to 15% of the signatures for qualifying for the ballot have been gathered, those signatures are then filed with the Secretary of State, and that triggers the ballot title process. And then the ballot title process in Senate Bill 102 goes forward just as it currently does under current law today. And then upon completion of the ballot title process, then they go through the normal signature gathering process under the certified ballot title for the rest of the signatures to qualify for the ballot. The rationale behind having that 10% signature gathering requirement is to address what has become really an institutional concern about ballot title shopping. And it's interesting to me that so much of the discussion of the initiative process boils down to ballot titles and marketing of ballot titles. It strikes me that really the thrust and the important thing behind the initiative process is the initiative measure itself. That, I think, is where the focus should be. It's the idea, what is actually going to become law, that should be the focus, as opposed to the ballot title. We hear a lot of complaints about ballot titles that are drafted by our office. Sometimes those have merit, sometimes they don't. I'd posit to you that one of the reasons that there is some concern about ballot titles that are drafted by our office is that we do the best professional legal job that we can do to accurately describe the measure itself and the effect of that measure. The chief petitioners and other people involved in the process sometimes have a different view of what the intent behind that measure was. The intent behind that measure isn't what drives, nor should it, the ballot title process. Somebody could intend to have one effect, but if the proposed measure has a different effect, it would do a serious disservice to the voting public to be misled. And so one of our institutional concerns in however we go about doing the ballot title process is to make sure that the end result of the ballot title is something that is forced institutionally, and all the incentives and mechanisms are designed to get an accurate ballot title to the voting public. That's the driving force that hopefully will be the driving force behind any legislation that comes out of this body. To do anything else is to mislead the voting public, and that is an institutional concern that we have. And so the idea behind the 10% signature gathering threshold in Senate Bill 102 was to have some mechanism in place to avoid ballot title shopping. Because what we have experienced, and in my written testimony, I lay out for you the experience that our office has seen over the last couple of election cycles. The one that I'm most familiar with was the last election cycle, where we had 183 proposed measures that came to our office for proposed measures for ballot title drafting. On 180 of those, three of those were withdrawn. We drafted ballot titles. Those went through either simply a certified ballot title process by our office. I think it was 96 of them or 92 of them that went through the Supreme Court for challenge. Because under the current statute, there's a draft ballot title, a comment period, a certified ballot title issued by our office. Anybody who's unhappy with that certified ballot title can challenge it in the Supreme Court. So 92 or 96 of those cases went to the Supreme Court. Out of the 180 that had ballot titles issued, only 47 of the petitioners in those cases, after they had an approved ballot title, ever went back to the Secretary of State for signature gathering. And then through the signature gathering process, only 7 qualified for the ballot. So out of the initial 180 that had ballot titles and potential litigation over them, and half of them did have litigation, only 7 of them ultimately appeared on the ballot. So what we're trying to create is a mechanism to address the problem that we have multiple filings and filings by people who never intend to gather signatures on their proposals. Our review of the 180 measures showed that about 70 of them were mere duplicates of each other. And consequently, I mean, if you have, why I said my comments at the outset, that I think the focus needs to be on the idea, the proposed measure itself. I don't understand the motivation for filing numerous duplicates other than to engage in ballot title shopping. The 10% signature gathering threshold, there's nothing written in stone or cast in concrete about that. There's nothing talismanic about that. That was a guess as to the appropriate level of requirement to show that the people were serious about proposing the measure, that the time and expense involved in ballot title litigation was expended on measures that had some momentum behind them and some interest and some chance of getting on the ballot. That's the entire purpose behind the 10% signature gathering. Senate Bill 102 left ballot title drafting responsibility in our office, the Attorney General's office. We don't have a vested interest in doing ballot title drafting. If there's another mechanism out there that will lead to accurate, impartial, effective, efficient ballot title drafting, that's fine. We have a level of legal resources that we can call upon. We have experience over the years of doing ballot title drafting that I think makes our office the best repository for that responsibility. Legislative Council is certainly a capable institution that could do it as well, too. And it, I think they would need additional resources to do it. But as long as the mechanism that's in place leads to an accurate, impartial ballot title at the end of the process, that's the driving purpose behind my concern, our concerns. We do have, you know, 200 attorneys in our office that we can call upon in various subject matters. And the breadth of ballot title, the breadth of proposed measures runs clear across the board, from sophisticated, complex tax matters to the Major 7 matter that Mr. Day was talking about. In fact, Major 7 led to, I think it was a 250-page legal opinion out of our office.
Madam Chair. Mr. Tradel, you have made the comment in your second paragraph about these duplicate filings. And I assume there is a reason for that, and I assume you know why they're putting in duplicate titles. So I also notice on the committee report that it says that while you're preparing the ballot title, the petitioner is prohibited from gathering more signatures. Is that the reason for the duplicates? Because if you do not act in a timely manner, they cannot collect further signatures.
Vice Chair Flores, Representative Close. The ballot title process is governed by strict statutory timelines. And our office has either 5 business days to issue a draft ballot title, a 10-business day comment period, and a 10-business day period for us to file a certified ballot title. And so that is all driven by statute. There are no opportunities for any kind of inadvertent delays built into the process. I can only surmise about why duplicate measures are filed. I think that part of those are driven by the interest in having a different ballot title for the second duplicative measure. Because otherwise I see no purpose in filing a duplicative measure unless you're making substantive policy changes between the measures. If you're doing that, that's totally fine and I think totally legitimate use of the ballot title process. Because you may have competing alternative policies that you want to get out and figure out which one makes the most sense that you really think you want to go with. But if there aren't significant policy changes, I don't understand the incentives for having duplicate measures.
But would you agree that if the Attorney General is not acting in a timely manner, that the petitioner is slowed down in collecting signatures and that makes their job more difficult?
Vice Chair Flores, Representative Close, again, there's really no mechanism available for the Attorney General's office or our office to delay the proceedings. All of our timelines are driven by statute. The only period of time that is open is once it's at the Supreme Court challenge level, where that can take a different period of time depending upon the court's docket, the court's caseload, how quickly it issues an opinion and can refer the measure back to us if need be. But all of our actions are driven by statutory timelines.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Barnhart?
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you receive two essentially identical petitions, do you have to assign different ballot titles to them? Could you assign the same ballot title because they're essentially the same?
Vice Chair Flores, Representative Barnhart. Actually, if we received two identical measures, we would, despite what Mr. Day says, issue identical ballot titles for those. There is a statutory prohibition in drafting substantially similar ballot titles if it will confuse the voters. There was a Supreme Court decision issued a few years ago that said, however, where they're identical measures or virtually identical measures, it would be confusing and misleading if they didn't have the same or very similar ballot titles. So if we get two identical measures in, we would draft two identical ballot titles.
Okay. Well, let me follow up on that. Then you say you've got 70 that were duplicate proposals. I'm assuming then that you must have filed 35, assuming that we're talking about sets of two here, that you filed 35 titles for those 70 measures.
Vice Chair Flores, Representative Barnhart, I may have been overly, maybe a slightly inaccurate in calling them duplicate because I don't believe they were absolutely duplicative. Some of them were probably duplicative, but some of them probably were virtually identical. I did not take the time nor have the resources to go back over and review whether our ballot titles tracked word for word or whether the measures tracked word for word.
Well, let me see if I can get at, if I may, get at this a little bit differently. I'm assuming because of SB 102 that Attorney General Myers considers this a significant issue, or he wouldn't have proposed a bill. But I'm still trying to, I'm wondering if I understand what the issue is that he's concerned about. If you have a measure that is essentially the same as a different measure, maybe not exactly identical, but in terms of the policy that it proposes would have the same outcome. Would you then put the same ballot title on each of those two measures, or not?
Vice Chair Flores, Representative Barnhart. Yes, we would put either the identical or a very, very similar ballot title on all of those measures. In fact, I personally was involved a number of years ago in what became a very iterative process where there was a tax measure that was dealing with income tax levels and corporate income and excise tax levels. And five, I think it was, versions of those matters were presented, all of them very, very, very much the same until they got down to differentiations in the distribution of how the income that was generated from those tax proposals would be distributed. Some of them said that X percentage would go to schools. I'm not remembering completely. You know, or X percentage would go to public safety, something like that. The ballot titles that our office issued had captions that were the same, yes and no vote statements that were the same, dealt with the differences in the distribution in the summary piece because that was the only place that enough words existed to deal with those. The concern that Attorney General Hardy Myers and our office shares with, I think, a number of other constituencies is that a tremendous amount of time and effort and court resources get expended on matters that are never followed through with, and some of those are generated by the fact that the people have either submitted alternative proposals seeing which ballot title they liked better if they got different ones. There is an incentive right now because the ballot title is generated only upon the filing of 25 sponsorship signatures that once a ballot title gets issued, and this harkens back to Representative Close's question about the delay, there's an incentive for people to challenge ballot titles that are issued because that does hold up signature gathering during the pendency of the Supreme Court review of that ballot title. Actually, until a certified ballot title is issued, you can't gather signatures. So our proposal doesn't go as far as, you know, negating the delay factor, but at least the 10% signature gathering means that the time and the expenditure of time and resources of the court system, our office, the party's participant, are expended on matters that people intend to follow through with, and there's some showing that there's a serious nature about them wanting to get it on the ballot. When the 10% signatures count towards the ultimate qualification for the ballot, so there's nothing about the Senate Bill 102 that has come over from the Senate side that increases the number of signatures that need to be gathered to qualify something for the ballot. It's simply an attempt to create a mechanism so that all the costs associated with the ballot title litigation practice are expended on measures that actually have a showing of support.
Thank you.
Question? Representative Mamas Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you had 103 measures and only 47 went to signature gathering, I would assume that part of the assumption of the Attorney General's office is that requiring the signature gathering would decrease the number of initiatives that are filed.
Vice Chair Flores, Representative Mons Anderson, that's accurate. It would be our understanding that because there are time and resource requirements to gather signatures. And as I said, the 10% is no magical figure. We're trying to come to the right kind of entry cost, if you will. We don't want to make it too hard for people to engage in the ballot title process because, yes, there are some people who have concerns about, you know, the ballot title. But if there's right now, it only requires 25 sponsorship signatures to trigger the entire process. Our suggestion would be that something substantially more than 25 is appropriate. Where that right result is a matter of policy to determine what the right place that is. But the idea behind having some signature gathering threshold is that, yes, it would mean that the ballot title process doesn't get triggered for all 180 measures that were proposed last session or last cycle.
And one other question, follow-up? Yeah, thank you. If you had these initiatives coming into your office over the year, that would average right around 3.5 initiatives, initiatives a week. But how many attorneys in your office are assigned to this? How many attorneys does it take to do this?
Vice Chair Flores, Representative Morris Anderson. How we have proceeded to staff ballot titles is there's a working group of identified assistant attorneys general that are in the appellate division who are kind of act as a pool for doing ballot title drafting. That the number in there has fluctuated, but right now I think it is approximately 10 or so. In the testimony, I've laid out how many attorney hours are expended by our office in the ballot title drafting and then ballot title litigation processes. And I think it works out to be, if I recall right, somewhere in the 3,000 hour per biennium amount. Vice Chair Flores, if I could, I'd like to address some comments to the A7 amendments as well. I know I'm taking up a lot of the committee's time, and I thank you for your indulgence. We've only had a little bit of time to ourselves try and digest the A7 amendments. And, I would like to reserve the opportunity, and hopefully, I wish Chair Doyle were here to suggest to him that I hope this can be an ongoing conversation, that we can work our way through what might make the most sense. The changes in the major elements that we perceive in the A7 amendments that are changes are, rather than having a 10% signature gathering threshold, it has changed it to a 1,500 verified sponsorship signatures or a filing fee. If there is to be some kind of a threshold, I think that it would be significant for the committee and then the legislature as a whole to keep in mind that I don't think you want to have a differentiation along the lines of just simply who has dollars and who doesn't have dollars. And I think that having it or that you can have just pay money, I think would have an inherently discriminatory effect on favoring organizations that have money. Now, that said, of course, gathering signatures involves, time and expense as well. But the gathering of signatures can be done by grassroots organizations that may not have, capital and money at their fingers. So I think very serious consideration needs to be given about differentiating along the lines of dollars and signatures.
Madam Chair, question?
Representative Close.
Thank you. Mr. Schrader, it comes to mind that is the same process for political candidates. They can gather petition signatures or they can pay a fee. Are you opposed to that also?
Vice Chair Flores, Representative Close. No, I'm simply positing that I think it's an issue that I think you need to give serious consideration to as to whether that is how you would like to have the initiative process be triggered. And I'm simply pointing out that I think there is a question there to be addressed. For individuals who might choose to engage in political campaigns or not, I think that's a different question than the initiative process that is by Constitution reserved as a co-equal power to the people. I mean, it's really the people's power that we're talking about here. The fact that the proposal changes a participant in the ballot title drafting process from our office to the Legislative Council's office is really, and I don't mean this too glibly, it's neither here nor there from our office's perspective. We respect and admire Legislative Council's legal acumen, fine. Concerns would be, if it goes to Legislative Council, we certainly think the Legislative Council will need to have legal resources, available to do this work. The fact that this process is that any other elector can file a draft ballot title simultaneously with Legislative Council, and that is the mechanism, I just want to highlight, is a different mechanism than currently exists, because the current mechanism is our office issues a draft ballot title, we get comments in that can well include an alternative proposal for a ballot title. that comment period and those comments that come in are a very, very helpful vehicle. It's a way for an explanation and a conversation of sorts to be engendered. If all you are getting is alternatively competing ballot titles, there isn't an institutionalized mechanism for any kind of really kind of persuasion or explanation to be given. So the bare bones, just exchange of competing ballot titles, I think needs to be at least a consideration too. The comment period we have found to be extremely beneficial to our office's drafting of ballot titles.
Okay. Representative Flores.
Thank you. Mr. Schradl, a couple of times now you have referred to whether legislative council would have the required resources. I'd like to dig a little deeper on that. What about their resources would you say is not adequate to handle this mission?
Chair Doyle, Vice Chair Flores. As I said in brief passing, our office has about 200 attorneys that we can call upon. Well, I said that there's a pool of 10 people who draft ballot titles. Quite often there will be conversations between one of those attorneys and a person in our tax section, for example. We have people in general counsel who do work with various licensing boards, the entire gamut of state business, and we have trial division with respect to civil litigation. I'm just suggesting that our office does have legal resources that, you know, we can bring to bear on these questions. Legislative Council has a great cadre of attorneys. You know, I'm not suggesting at all that they are not competent, totally fine attorneys. I'm not sure that they necessarily have the opportunity to have the same kind of exposure that our attorneys do in the daily workings. One of the biggest difficulties and most important pieces of ballot title drafting is an explanation of current law and how the proposed measure would change current law. Sometimes it is not an easy matter to determine actually what the status of current law is and what the effect of the proposed measure would be upon current law. And so it's both time-consuming and requires some legal experience, and I'm just suggesting that I think we have more legal resources to call upon than Legislative Council does. Not that the quality is better.
Thank you.
Having the review of the ballot titles go to a three-judge panel is, an idea that I think has a lot of merit. For one thing, it takes it out of the Supreme Court, which is an overburdened court. But there are some costs associated with the three-judge panel as well. It's my understanding that those retired judges are currently being called upon, and the resources are currently being called upon to deal with cases that are in the judicial system elsewhere. So this isn't solely a kind of gift of the availability of these judges. Moving them to ballot titles will move them away from other matters. And I have the same concern with the three-judge panel that I was expressing just a moment ago, that as I perceive the proposal, the only information that goes to the three-judge panel will be the competing ballot titles. When challenge is made, what gets forwarded to the three-judge panel are the alternative ballot titles that people have proposed. The current process for Supreme Court challenge has not only does the Secretary of State compile the comments that were filed, but then also there is a petition and a memorandum in opposition that are filed that set out the competing arguments as to why one formulation of the ballot title is in one person's view better and another formulation is better in the other party's view. That dialogue, again, I think has helped and would help the decision maker. Now, one other piece of this that is mechanistically a little difficult is that if none of the competing ballot titles are deemed to be compliant with statutory requirements, that then it simply goes through another iterative process. I don't know that the mechanism that the three-judge panel, and because of the constituency of the three-judge panel moving from panel to panel to panel, and the extremely short timelines that are associated with those panels, would lead to the three-judge panel generating any kind of an opinion or guidance as to why they found none of the competing ballot titles to comply with the statute or not. It is just a bit troublesome to us that there isn't much of an opportunity for what we would call dialogue or argument back and forth. The three-judge panel would simply have before it the bare-bones ballot titles, and then would say none of these comply, send it back, and without, now there could be practice developed by the three-judge panels to generate opinions of guidance that would then lead practitioners as well as, of course, the counsel's office, as well as participants, other participants, to know what they need to do in the three-judge panel's eye to comply with the statutory requirements. One of the things that we currently have, having it deposited in the Supreme Court, is they issue published opinions. And you can refer back to those published opinions for guidance if you have a similar measure, a substantially similar measure come up. You know how the court has dealt with that kind of a similar issue before. Here, unless there's some kind of a reporting mechanism, there's not going to be the institutional memory developed, and there'd be a little loss of that we worry about. And so consequently, I think that what the proposal does is move it from kind of a dialogue and argumentation framework where the public has an opportunity to file through comments and persuasion and a centralized person or entity in our office, it's the Attorney General's office, drafting the ballot title. It moves it to a kind of competing ball field where you would choose one and not have any guidance necessarily for the court in choosing that one. I have a few comments that I'd like to also address to the review of the Secretary of State's constitutional procedural compliance matters. The process that is in here is much the same as the process that was in Senate Bill 102. By that I mean once the 1,500 verified signatures under this proposal are submitted, that triggers a 10-day comment period for people to file comments with the Secretary of State about whether they believe the measure constitutionally complies with separate vote, single subject, full text revision kinds of questions, and then a 10 business day opportunity for the Secretary of State to render a decision. All of that mirrors what's in Senate Bill 102, and that is all fine. And I'm not saying that the next piece is not fine, but there's a big policy question involved with the next piece. This imposes a requirement that anybody who wishes to challenge the Secretary of State's determination must do so within 21 days in Marion County Circuit Court, and that is the exclusive way for somebody to challenge that. I'm not suggesting that that is a bad thing, but there are fiscal matters that come along with that. Again, to use the figures from last election cycle, there were 183 or 180. Assume that the 1,500 verified signatures reduces that by some number. Let's use 100 as an example. Right now, under A7, if anybody wanted to challenge the constitutional procedural determination by the Secretary of State, they would have to do so at the beginning. I would guarantee that a substantially higher percentage of them would be challenged under this proposal than under current law, because under current law, if something is not approved by the Secretary of State, that ends the matter, so that would be the same. But if something is approved for signature gathering, there are a couple of additional hurdles before that ever appears on a ballot. One, you have to gather the requisite number of signatures, and you might also have to get it approved by the voters. There are a couple of different later points that people could choose not to challenge the Secretary of State's determination. Now, there are some policy choices at every point here, because I'm not here to suggest to you that it is a very good matter if something has gone through the entire election, has been voted on by the voting public and approved, and then somebody challenges it and says it never should have gone before the voters because it was constitutionally defective, and the court says you're right, it shouldn't have, and voids it. That's not a very palatable situation for anybody involved with the process. I don't think the court likes it. I don't think it's a good expenditure of resources. But contrarily, that if you force all of those to be litigated at the very beginning, you will have 100 challenges, and challenges on measures that either would never get signatures or two would never pass. And so it simply is a resource allocation matter that's a big policy choice, I think, for the legislature to determine. It's going to force an awful lot more litigation up front in the process, and there will be a big fiscal impact for our office, for other party litigants, for the court system because they will deal with many more cases. But it will avoid the circumstance where you would go through the entire election process, have the voters approve it, and then have it struck down. But that is, there will be fiscal costs associated with that. I've been...
Further questions?
Chair Doyle, before I leave, you were out of the office when I, or out of the chambers when I said this. I do hope this isn't just an ongoing conversation because we've only had a rudimentary opportunity really to address it. Love to work with you further on, I mean, I don't think it at all, I wouldn't suggest that it's unworkable. I think there's some pieces in it that need further attention if you want to go that direction. The last piece is Senate Bill 102 could be changed to simply revert to having legislative counsel supplanted for our office. That's one other option that's out there.
Thank you. Chris and Leonard.
Chair Doyle, members of the committee, I'm Kristen Leonard, and I'm with the Oregon Education Association. Just briefly wanted to touch upon Senate Bill 102 in the version that came over from the Senate. Wanted to express our support of that version and to give you a couple reasons as to why we are supporting that. As an organization, we've always felt that any changes to the ballot title process needed to kind of meet two criteria, I'd say. And one is to rein in this practice of ballot title shopping. And the other would be to demonstrate, to show a demonstration of public support prior to starting this ballot title process and kind of a process that's not only expensive for the state, but organizations that end up getting involved as well. And just wanted to comment on both those things. I mean, OEA believes that the current system of ballot title shopping really abuses the intent of Oregon's initiative process as it was first put together by allowing petitioners to establish a procedure to kind of poll for the optimum ballot title as they would see it and something that would be most beneficial, I think, when they go through the campaign process. And our belief is that Senate Bill 102 would cut down on this ballot title shopping to by requiring a show of citizen support for a specific measure or policy up front. And in the version that came over to you from the Senate, it is required that 10 to 15% of the signatures be gathered prior to this ballot title process. And those signatures do count towards your total, so it in no way adds any additional signatures, any additional workload in that respect to what you're already planning on doing as a chief petitioner. It just requires those up front. And we feel that this will not serve as a hindrance, but rather kind of a benchmark in showing, demonstrating support from the public prior to starting the ballot title process. And the other thing is the current system as it stands necessitates a long-term commitment of time and money by citizens, whether you are looking at this from the perspective of the chief petitioner, but also those citizens that feel it's important to participate in this drafting process by commenting and tracking the process of the ballot title. The recent escalation in submitted measures has resulted in a similar and staggering escalation in expenses to the public in being involved with this process through legal fees and tracking costs. And requiring that approximately 10,000 signatures be gathered prior to initiating the ballot title process, we believe that Senate Bill 102 will require that the petitioner kind of demonstrate this public support, and we won't have just measure after measure introduced to for the purpose of polling for the optimum ballot title. So I just want to express OEA's support of Senate Bill 102 as it came to you from the Senate.
Questions?
Yes.
Representative Moss Anderson.
Thank you. Did you have a chance to look at the A7 amendments?
Very briefly, yeah.
So you wouldn't be able to comment on those, on what you would like or didn't like in that. It decreases the number of signatures.
Yes, and we're supportive of that. I think the concern with the change in the signatures is the element that says, or you may pay the $1,500. I think the concern is then the likelihood of anyone actually going out to gather signatures is pretty slim, and this just cuts out the demonstration of public support. If OEA decides as a chief petitioner that we, you know, we're interested in introducing a measure into the process, knowing that we could just pay $1,500 versus the 1,500 signatures, I think just cuts out any demonstration. Right now, as it is, at least we would have to go gather 25 signatures. And so I guess that would be my one concern with that element.
Representative Fornheim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make sure I heard you correctly. You were supporting the SB 102 with the 10,000 signature requirement.
Correct.
But you would also support the A8s, which don't exist yet, which would be the A7s minus the $1,500 requirement.
Vice Chair,
I'm starting to understand what your position is. I don't want to trap you into something.
No, that's fine. Vice Chair Flores and Representative Barnhart, my concern is more with the dollar amount. I think as Phil Schradl had mentioned earlier, I think the 10% is something that everyone has been talking about. Is that the right number? I still believe that 10% is a very appropriate number, but I think my concern is more with offering a dollar amount as an option.
If I could follow up. You would have fewer objections anyway to any requirement that required more signatures than the current rule than you do to this measure that would allow you to do it without any signatures at all if you're
correct.
Able to pay money. Thank you.
Anything further? Thank you.
Thank you.
Bill Perry and Julie Brandis.
Thank you, Vice Chair Flores, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Perry. I'm Director of Government Relations for the Oregon Restaurant Association. And we are supportive of Senate Bill 102A as it came over. And I want to speak basically from a third-party perspective. We don't initiate initiative petitions at this point, and I can't think of more than one or two that are actually initiative petitions that I've ever helped pass. I'm generally more of a defensive mode as a third party. And our membership basically pays us to watch any government or legislative process, so to speak, at all. So one of the things that I have to do as somebody that watches, I pay an attorney to track it, just because as the previous speakers have said, there's been 180 initiatives that are filed, and I'm not an expert on all of them and how they'll affect me, so what happens is I pay a attorney to watch them. The attorney then comes back and tells me that we really have to, on anything that directly has a direct impact on my industry, I have to file a challenge for, just because I need standing in any future proceedings. If you don't, you basically have no standing. What happens in this case is I pay anywhere from $1,700, and the most I've ever paid is $7,000, to go through the challenge process. That averages out, when you look at it, to about $2,800 to $3,000 per challenge. What happens is when you look at two election cycles ago, there were either 9 or 10, I didn't have a chance to look up my records, that we filed a challenge or paid to participate in a challenge. Out of those 9 to 10 subjects or initiatives, they were on 3 different subjects. So most of those were repeated measures that I would term as ballot title shopping. Of those, none of those went out for signature gathering. So I can't remember the exact dollar amount, but I just spent $26,000 on 9 to 10 initiatives that basically people collected 25 signatures on. So I'm out a lot of money. I was forced to participate for the most part, even though somebody didn't go out for signatures. The last initiative cycle, There were seven that had a direct impact on my industry. They were on two different subjects, only two subjects, and only one of them went out for signature gathering and eventually made it on the ballot, which I spent about $20,000 in the same thing on seven different initiatives. Only one went out to ballot. I, at this point, have not had any problems with the appeals process. I have seen, as some of the previous speakers have said, that some problems with ballot titles as they've come out, and I think some of the speakers have talked about they've got most of those rectified through the initiative process. But the issue is that when we look at why we are supporting 102 is, when am I, as a third party that actually have nothing to do with the initiative, when am I required to basically step up and participate? And when you look at the current system today, somebody is collecting 25 signatures and can walk away from it. I still cannot take the risk of not participating in a $3,000 level. And remember, even though they walk away from it, I have had people call me up and say they were thinking about picking up the initiative that somebody else filed for 25 signatures. So I, as somebody who tries to protect an industry, and I'm not saying my industry, when you look at the 180 initiatives, I'm sure there's somebody defending every one of those industries. When am I would just like to have somebody else participate at some level before I have to get involved. And 25 signatures, in my opinion, is way too low. If somebody thinks 10% is too high, I don't mind having that discussion, but still at 1,500, I would still argue that I think that's a little bit low, because if you're really making the correlation that somebody does in this bill of $1,500 and 1,500 signatures is equal, you're still not up to half the cost that I have as an industry getting involved in this process. So all we are asking is somebody that's a third party, when do I have to get involved? And it's been our position, and I think you'll find a lot of other trade associations that are not directly involved in getting something on the measure, 25 signatures is too low to make a third party get involved. And I'll let the government decide whether they should have to spend the money and everything else, but I'm just saying, as a third party in this process, I think 25 signatures is way too low. And with that, I'd be happy to answer questions, sir.
Thank you. Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Julie Brandis with Associated Oregon Industries. And AOI did not come into this legislation lightly, but we did so for many of the same reasons as expressed by Mr. Perry. Our own organization utilizes grassroots activity to our advantage often, and I'm sure you've all felt the impacts of that from time to time with phone calls from our members and so on. But our issue with getting involved in this relates more to the signatures that are gathered as opposed to trying to limit grassroots activity. And we would argue that, as Mr. Perry has somewhat has stated, that 25 signatures really isn't enough of a grassroots activity. We believe that there should be broader commitment involved before you start to before someone starts to shop a ballot title. 25 signatures is, in reality, our family's Christmas dinner, and on a good day, I guess, because we usually have a lot more. But once a ballot title is filed, as Mr. Perry has stated, members of the business community often have to take a look at it in a defensive posture and understand whether it impacts the business community. If it does, who is the lead, or which business association is going to have to take that lead? And in the same case, do we need standing? And as Mr. Perry has stated again, you know, what is the risk if we don't get standing on this issue? And then we have to challenge it, and this is where the financial impact comes in. And that happens all right away, within just a few weeks of the filing. So we have to commit, or the third party has to commit financially and immediately. And who knows what the person who originally, or the group who originally filed this 25 signatures is going to do with what they originally asked for. So what we're asking for with Senate Bill 102, and when we lent our support to the legislation, is that there should be one, a group should demonstrate just broader support for an initiative before the third party, or we, or the business community, or whomever it might be, has to get involved. And I'll be happy to respond to any questions.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I take it that you face similar kinds of costs to those described by the Restaurant Association.
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, that is correct.
So in any given two-year period, you're spending somewhere around $30,000 or so just watching this process and getting involved in those issues that you think may be important to your members.
Madam Vice Chair, Representative Barnhart, actually, I have to say we have not been as active in the process as the Restaurant Association. They've actually been leaders for the business community and often noted to us when something was involved. We have not had to invest as much in the challenge process as we probably will in the upcoming years. As the it seems to us, the business community is more, getting challenged more frequently at the through the initiative system.
Vice Chair, Representative Barnhart, I do want to say, and I hope I'm not impugning different people's motives on this, but when you look at the activity of the initiative system over the past few years, a high majority have not been what I would call broad-based measures. They've been a lot more what I would call, in a personal opinion, a targeted, you know, whether it's unions, you know, the Restaurant Association or anything else. A lot of the measures are targeted at specific industries, so I would say general groups haven't needed the standing as much. And I mean, there's a few of them that they've taken the lead on, maybe a workers' comp issue or something like that. But most of the ballots, when you look at the multiple titles, have been filed at a specific interest group. And I don't think business unions or anybody else has been less of a target than anybody else. I mean, it's really kind of the way it's gone over the last cycle. And so I would say your specific interest groups are the ones that are probably spending some of the money. If they some of the general business groups, we may ask to participate if it's, you know, can affect more than just us. But I think the industry specific groups have been a bigger target over just the last probably 2 to 3 cycles.
Thank you. That helped.
Thank you, and we did add a third panel member.
Thank you, Vice Chair Flores. For the record, Patrick Green with the Oregon AFL-CIO, and I just wanted to join the chorus of supporters for Senate Bill 102 as it came over from the Senate. We do believe that ballot titles are important. They're also time-consuming and costly, both for the state and for interested parties, and we have the same sorts of experience with it as AOI and the Oregon Restaurant Association. I do think that it's worth noting and should be worth something that this is a bill that came over from the Senate from the support of AOI, the Oregon AFL-CIO, the Oregon Restaurant Association, the Oregon Education Association, and I think that demonstrates consensus around the issue of the problem for ballot title shopping. And basically what you've heard is that, you know, we shouldn't put forward this thing and put this thing in motion until there's really demonstrated support. And also that, I mean, I'd like to caution the committee to be careful about getting this whole ballot title process, which is a bureaucratic legal process, and not wrapped up in the around the initiative process and the right of the people, and the right to a ballot title is not sacrosanct. The initiative process is, but having a ballot title, I mean, one of the best processes, I think we would all agree, is if people did what you do as legislators, which is just have the law and read the law and judge it on that. And we do have ballot titles and we can't get rid of them, but we need to be careful that this process doesn't get caught up in the initiative process. There are hundreds of titles that are filed, hundreds of initiatives that are filed every year. Many of them get ballot titles. Many of them have no challenges. Many of them never go forward, and not one signature is gathered beyond the first 25. Why should the people pay for that? Two other things to add is not to leave the Supreme Court out. They have experience in this in the case law. Same thing with the Attorney General is more experienced. One thing I'd caution on legislative counsel, we think they're great as well. I think trying to And it's a resource question that the legislature can decide whether or not to put the resources there. But if in the middle of session and then there's people doing ballot titles, I mean, do you want them doing ballot titles or writing law here? But that's a decision for you all to make. And then the last thing is this whole $1,500 is a real problem. I mean, basically, it puts right there ballot title shopping. If I can do it for $1,500, I'll get out my credit card and can buy a ballot title. That's something that we really need to look at in this amended version, and we do need a higher threshold. And again, with our folks from Restaurant Association AOI, we would support 102A as it came across. It's a consensus bill. Thank you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. I apologize to Representative Close.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to ask Julie Brandis specifically, and also the Restaurant Association. We've had testimony in the A7s about the three-judge panel that would be appointed by the Supreme Court, picking the ballot titles or establishing a process until they reach an acceptable ballot title. Is that part of the A7 amendments, something that you're in support of?
Vice Chair Flores, Representative Close. At this point, just from our standpoint, I have not had any problems with the appeals process. So I would have to obviously have our attorneys look at it to see what their opinion is, but I haven't seen a need for a change of the appeals process. Whether or not people are getting bad titles, I've seen some that I didn't think were fair titles, so I'm not arguing that standpoint. But as of right now, there hasn't been any concern from anybody that I've been dealing with on changing the appeals process. So I guess just before I could answer, I would need to know more what exactly the problem was that people are having, and then I could see whether or not that addresses it. I haven't heard anybody talk about the appeals process not working, in my two cents.
Madam Vice Chair, Representative Close, I will probably just piggyback onto what Bill said. Again, the original reason why AOI got involved with this legislation was 25 signatures does not constitute what we would call a grassroots level of support. That's where our real interest in the legislation falls. As for the rest of the A7s, I am not enough an expert on the rest of the process to say right here, right now, whether that would be something we could support, and I'd probably defer to Bill's counsel, the Restaurant Association's counsel on that.
So you're understanding the question. I'm just asking you about the difference between the AG writing this or the three-judge panel.
Madam, do you want to respond?
Vice Chair Flores, Representative Close. As in writing the title, I don't know enough about three-judge panel. That's something I'd be more than happy to look at. I haven't dealt with the judges before, at least from an industry standpoint. You know, maybe discretions in my youth I might have, but I haven't dealt with the judges before from that standpoint. So I can't tell you right now whether or not I think that's a good or bad change.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Dan Meek, please.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair Flores and members. My name is Dan Meek. I'm an attorney in Portland. I wrote testimony and testified on this Senate Bill 102 before the Senate on behalf of Oregon Common Cause, the Coalition for Initiative Rights, and the Pacific Green Party, all of which very strenuously oppose Senate Bill 102A as it emerged from the Senate. Regarding the -7 amendments, I would generally strongly support the -7 amendments, and I think the arguments brought up against them by Mr. Schradl can be easily overcome. For example, we could easily have the parties who have submitted draft ballot titles to the three-judge panel include arguments in favor of their ballot titles to the three-judge panel. One important feature, I think, is that all the information to the panel should be submitted blind, that is, not identified as to source, so the three-judge panel can evaluate the proposed ballot titles without knowing who submitted them and without allowing any possibility of bias to creep into the process. Also, there's absolutely nothing would prevent the three-judge panels from issuing written opinions, which would provide the kind of institutional memory that Mr. Schradl is concerned about. Regarding the statement about the constitutional process, what we really call the Armada compliance process, because it's based primarily upon the Supreme Court's decision in Armada, Mr. Schradl said under A7, you might see 100 different challenges going to the courts on the constitutional procedural requirements a year. But what he didn't take into consideration was most ballot measures are statutory, and there are no constitutional procedural requirements applicable to them. Armada is only applicable to constitutional amendment initiatives, not to statutory initiatives. So that cuts this number by about two-thirds to begin with. And the reason that people, of course, would need to litigate the Secretary of State determines to be not in compliance with the constitutional procedural requirements is because, as Mr. Schradl himself stated, I think he said, right now the Secretary of State's decision is unreviewable. Well, technically that's not true. Technically you can file a lawsuit in circuit court and then appeal that to the Court of Appeals and then appeal that to the Supreme Court. But it is on a practical basis unreviewable because those processes take so long and there are no time limits on any of those processes. But if the Secretary of State determines that a measure doesn't satisfy the Armada requirements, that's the end of it. It's a completely unreviewable decision. And right now the way that process works is that once you file a prospective petition, the Secretary of State has 10 days to accept comments from, well, then the Attorney General issues a draft ballot title. Then there's a 10-day period for the Secretary of State to accept comments on whether or not the measure complies with the Armada requirements, whether it's more than one amendment to the Constitution, whether it complies with the full text requirement, and those sorts of things. But there's only one round of comments. So what typically happens is that those who oppose a measure will file their comments claiming that it does not comply with Armada during the last 5 minutes of the comment process, and that's absolutely the way it goes in. It comes in at 4:55 on the afternoon that the comments are due at the Secretary of State, typically by fax. That means that the measure proponents have no opportunity to respond to those challenges, those legal challenges to their measure. Then the Secretary of State makes a determination, which is, as Mr. Schradl pointed out, unreviewable. And that's the current process for determining whether a measure complies with the constitutional procedural requirements, which I think is an extremely bad process that we have today. I would like to spend a minute talking about the provisions of Senate Bill 102A because I'm not sure that you've been fully briefed on what it means. We think it would destroy the initiative process for grassroots organizations in Oregon while leaving it fully intact for those groups with sufficient money to hire a group of paid signature collectors under centralized control. What it actually requires is that the petitioners collect the first 10 to 15,000 signatures with no ballot title whatsoever. That is, you have a signature sheet, no ballot title. Instead, you would staple to every signature sheet the full text of the measure. Well, some measures can be pretty long by necessity. For example, ballot measure 11, which established minimum sentences, was extremely long because it had to define all of the crimes, it had to specify the minimum sentences, it had to specify exceptions, it had to specify when the courts could exercise their discretion, etc. So it's a very long measure, many pages. Under this measure, you have to collect the first 10 to 15,000 signatures with that staple to every sheet. The staple comes out, all the signatures on that sheet are invalid. Then what you have to do, and what we typically do is we have our signature sheets distributed statewide to hundreds and in some cases thousands of volunteers. The very crucial task is getting those signature sheets back. It's already very difficult to get them back during the first week of July when the signatures are due. Under SB 102A, you'd have to call them in at least twice. The first call-in is when you think maybe you've got 10,000 signatures out there in the field. But you can't know that you have 10,000 signatures until you call them back, so it's a chicken and egg problem. If you call them back and you don't have 10,000 signatures, then you have to ask to get the word out to all of your folks statewide to, okay, collect some more signatures. And hope, of course, that the full text of the measure doesn't fall off the signature sheet and render those signatures invalid. And, of course, appending the full text to every measure means you're going to have postage problems with envelopes returned for insufficient postage. But let's assume that you guess right, and you guess, yes, I think my supporters statewide have 10,000 signatures on these sheets, and so we get them back. Then you go through the ballot title process, and in the meantime, you have to stop collecting signatures. Then you get a ballot title. At that point, all of the signatures that are at any time subsequently collected on your original signature sheets are invalid. So if someone down in Burns or Baker has your signature sheet and is gathering signatures from their friends at events that they go to, they're not going to know that all of the signatures they're collecting at some point on a valid signature sheet then become invalid. Becomes invalid at the time that you go through the ballot title process. And then, if the Supreme Court decides to change any, even a single word of your ballot title, all of the signatures you collected on your second generation of signature sheets becomes invalid. So it really establishes, for grassroots organizations, an absolute logistical nightmare. It's already hard enough to get back the signatures once. You're saying get back the signatures twice, maybe even three times during the process. It absolutely would devastate grassroots organizations' attempts to collect signatures by volunteers. In addition, even if you, of course, collect all of the signatures and make it to the ballot, you can be rejected at the time that you're going for a ballot title after you've collected the first 10 to 15,000. You can still be rejected on Armada grounds. That is, the Secretary of State can still determine in that totally unreviewable process that your measure constitutes more than one amendment, in which case all of your 10 to 15,000 signatures goes down the drain. As it is under the current system, if the Secretary of State determines that your measure doesn't meet the Armada requirements, you can modify your measure and submit it again so that it meets those take out provisions that the Secretary of State and the Attorney General believe violate those requirements and submit it again. But under the SB 102A process, you've already gone to this mammoth effort to get your 10 to 15,000 volunteer signatures. Then you face an unreviewable determination by the Secretary of State that can keep you off the ballot, and there's nothing you can do about it except then try to go through three layers of court, with none of whom have any time limit at all, and as a result, it is an practically unreviewable decision. You simply cannot qualify for the ballot at all. So I also think it is extremely important to adopt the -A7 amendments pertaining to the constitutional procedural requirements. Let's get the challenges done up front. But I think the A7 amendments don't include enough to get that done. They don't establish any time limit for the Circuit Court of Marion County to make a determination. And, of course, it's in 99% of the cases going to be a preliminary determination anyway that will probably go to the Oregon Supreme Court. So I would think that you would want to either skip Marion County entirely or give them a statutory deadline for making that determination. And the same thing would be true if you go directly to the Supreme Court. Let's make a reasonable period of time for the Supreme Court to make a decision. In some of these cases involving constitutional procedural requirement, the Supreme Court has taken more, I know, at least a year and a half, I'm thinking 2 years, to make the determination. And if they can still take that amount of time under the A7 amendments, then it once again essentially makes the determination of the Secretary of State unreviewable, no matter what the courts ultimately decide.
Mr. Meek.
Thank you.
D.C., just a quick question to that last point. Of your knowledge, I guess, of our Constitution, do you see that the legislature can set deadlines for the judicial branch on this kind of issue?
I think they can.
Okay.
In addition, if you set a deadline, the choice that the court has is either to meet it or claim that it doesn't have to. If you don't set a deadline, then the court doesn't have to meet it and can perhaps take that as an affirmation of the current process under which the court can take several years to determine a constitutional procedural challenge. Just one other thing. Mr. Green of the AFL-CIO seemed to argue to you that SB 102A was a consensus, some kind of a consensus measure over on the Senate side. In fact, we thought that there was a very reasonable Senate minority report to Senate Bill 102A, which was defeated on the floor by a vote of 16 to 14. So there was certainly not consensus on the Senate side about what to do. Senate Bill 102A, I thought, made reasonable changes to the process. I mean, the minority report would have made reasonable changes to the process, but Senate Bill 102A itself just devastates the process for grassroots organizations. It basically says, unless you have a centralized core of paid signature gatherers, you're out of the initiative process. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meeker, what do you think of the criteria that
I think OEA mentioned explicitly, but I think the Oregon Restaurant Association and the others probably agree with that a good bill would rein in the process of ballot title shopping, and would also require that things that actually got to the stage of a ballot title would have already shown some public support for the issue to be considered.
Mm-hmm.
But those are sort of overarching criteria that they consider to be valuable in the process. What do you think about them and why?
Well, I'm not sure that ballot, Mr. Representative Barnhart, I'm not sure that ballot title shopping exists, because as Mr. Schradl pointed out, if a measure is submitted that is very similar to a petition that has been submitted before, the Attorney General assigns to it the same ballot title. So if you have similar measures and you keep submitting them over and over, you're not going to get a better ballot title, so what is it that you're shopping for? Let me give you an example of the case of an organization that I'm helping this time around on campaign finance reform. So far, we have submitted, I believe, five prospective petitions. But three of them have been rejected by the Secretary of State in the kind of unreviewable process that I've just described. We don't have a ballot title or a certified ballot title for any of them yet. So what we do, we submitted a proposed constitutional amendment. The Secretary of State, based on a letter from the Attorney General, said, well, that's more than one amendment because it includes a provision in it, for example, that would say that if a candidate has unused campaign funds at the end of a campaign, at the end of an election cycle, that money would be forfeited to the state of Oregon. That was one of the provisions in the measure. They said, well, that means that your campaign finance reform measure, constitutional amendment, is more than one amendment because it would implicitly amend the part of the Oregon Constitution that says that the government cannot take private property or without just compensation. Okay, that's something that we have national experts looking at this measure, and that's something that nobody had brought up ever before. So what we did is that we refiled that measure absent the offending provision. Now, if we had to have collected 10,000 to 15,000 signatures in the SB 102A process, we'd be done, because that would have taken so much time to go through that process twice that we'd simply not have time to collect the signatures on a volunteer basis. And when you're collecting signatures on a volunteer basis, it takes a lot of time. The two-year process itself is fully used by drafting the measure, submitting it, getting the ballot title, and collecting signatures. If we had to do the SB 102A process, once would be difficult enough. If we had to do it twice because of this scenario, it would be impossible.
Further questions? Okay. Thank you, sir. Jason Williams.
For the record, my name is Jason Williams, Executive Director of the Taxpayer Association of Oregon. It's great to be here, Chair Doyle, members of the committee. We would start out by just saying, on the intent and the ideas behind the Senate bill, we're worried about them not fixing the problem, but creating more problems, and not finding a solution that is fair, but rather trying to close one door and opening up many others that would cause more problems. Our idea is that the more you make the initiative process more difficult, it does you imbalance the whole process, because then only the money interest people can be able to afford to go through that process of having to gather the 10,000 signatures and whatnot. And that's one thing that we definitely don't want to see. And then, of course, with the logistical nightmare that would come out of going out there and telling people, hey, we've got this this petition out there, and a person signs it. They read the title that the Attorney General gave them. They sign it, and then suddenly it comes back around a few months later. Same petition, but now has a different title to it. Well, some people are going to sign that petition twice. Some people, out of fear of signing twice, are not going to sign it once. And so you can imagine that the system was really not meant to set up. The public needs something simple that they can understand, and not all these different measures out there that with different titles that it suddenly switch at a magic moment in time. I would like to quickly address this thing about title shopping, because I really feel like that's just
it's really not fair to look at all those 170 petitions out there. Each one has its own little story. I mean, and there are so many reasons why those measures didn't make it to the ballot. You know, we submitted two measures that were the exact same measures last election cycle, but we changed the measure just based upon the effectiveness date. So, and we didn't know, you know, how long it was going to take to get out of process or what the economy was going to do and how our measure would better. We just supplied two different measures, and of course, because it went through the existing process with so much legal challenges, by the time we got it, we only had about a few months left, so we had to let it go. So that's why our two out of the 170 never made it. And just having the same people submit extra ones, there may be a story behind it that needs further explanation outside of just ballot title shopping. You also talk about those are 170 initiatives. It's a 2-year period, so you got to take that into account too. But if you are a person, you're just a group of citizens in your town hall, and you come up with the world's greatest idea, and you get some lawyers involved, and you submit it to the Attorney General, and you just get back a ballot title that is, let's just say, it's just not representative of what your measure is. And you realize, boy, we've had this idea, we're going to try to tell people about it, and it's just not going to work. The idea does not match what our measure and what our idea is. And so there's a lot of people who are just going to say no. Now, there's sometimes when the court is right. The court may emphasize this point on the measure, and and so then you and this world's greatest idea, you realize, well, you know what, the court is right. We probably need to change our measure. Because the court was bringing up things we didn't even think about, or they're emphasizing this, they could either be right or wrong. And I wouldn't remind you that the courts have changed the Attorney General's ballot titles many, many times. So, of course, our Attorney General is not perfect, but if they're making a lot of mistakes or having a lot of corrections, I should probably say, then you can see the pressure that people feel that if the Supreme Court disagrees with them, well, sometimes they're going to disagree. So their disagreement is a legitimate right and a legitimate concern. And I would imagine on how this might apply to even legislative bills on how, we would not give a bill, a title or a summary, that important summary that we get on those legislative bills. But we're really not going to allow you to have it, or we're going to change it halfway if it gets out of committee. Or if it gets through the Senate, then we'll review it because it'll be a serious bill then, and then we'll give you a more accurate... It's that type of bureaucracy that we're trying to stay away from. We do like some of these ideas that have been brought on the table. The ability to submit your own ballot title as part of the process and just trying to be helpful, I think that's a great idea. And the three-judge, I think that's definitely worth looking into. But I just want to just emphasize on just how much more problems and bureaucracy you can cause by adding in these artificial limits. And also just on trying to take a deeper look at why a lot of those measures didn't make the ballot. And so you may be going after a smaller problem than you thought. The problem may not be very much of a problem at all. So thank you.
Questions? Okay, thank you. John Lineback.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Lindback, Director of Elections in the Secretary of State's office, and my challenge for the next 5 to 7 minutes will be to talk to you about statistical sampling and keep you awake at the same time. Because that's what I'm going to talk to you about is the statistical sampling process that we use in order to determine whether or not a petition has enough valid signatures to go on the ballot and how the A7 amendments would affect that. In brief, the A7 amendments will require us to redo our statistical sampling scheme, and we do have a consultant from Oregon State University that has helped us write our statistical sampling method for several years now, and we will have to go back to him and have him rewrite that as a result of Section 3 and the new requirement of 1,500 verified signatures up front, and that those signatures will count towards the in some way towards, you know, they'll get credit for those in order to get that initiative or constitutional amendment on the ballot. And in reviewing the A7 amendments, it's not immediately clear exactly how that should happen. And let me give you just a little bit of background information. For the current election cycle, a constitutional amendment will require 100,840 valid signatures in order to make the ballot. And a statutory change will require 75,630 valid signatures in order to make the ballot. Now, what the chief petitioners normally do is submit way in excess of what is required, because there is an assumption that a lot of those signatures they are gathering are not valid. And that is the reason for our sampling process. And under our statute, we have a statute that says that we do a sampling, that we in total sample no more than 5% of the signatures submitted, and that we do a first sample of 1,000 signatures. And if in that first sampling process it shows that they did not have enough valid signatures in the total amount, then we sample, we take a second sample and send it out to the counties, and they verify some more signatures. And the total sampled are no more than 5%, as I said, of the signatures submitted. And let me just give you an example. We had two statutory initiatives that made the ballot in the last election cycle. One was the Health Care for All initiative that some of you might remember, and another was the one dealing with genetically modified foods. Both of those made it to the ballot on the basis of the strength that they showed in the first sample. So we randomly selected 1,000 signatures out of the total submitted, and the total submitted under the Health Care Initiative for All was 97,506 signatures. And they needed to show that they had 666,786 valid signatures. The total submitted by the genetically modified foods petitioners was 99,390 signatures. And again, they had the same threshold to show. We have a computer program that helps us go through and randomly select 1,000 signatures on all of those sheets. And then we send them out to the counties, and the counties send the information back to us to tell us whether or not there are enough valid signatures, or how many valid signatures they had. We fit it into our formula, which is also computerized, and it's our statistician from Oregon State helped us put that formula together. And we work the numbers, and it determines whether or not they have shown through sampling that they have enough valid signatures. The total number of signatures that were ruled valid for the health care initiative in this process of sampling was 819. That was enough to get them on the ballot. The A7 amendments require 1,500 valid signatures up front, and that's okay. I mean, we have no objections to that, but it requires us to redo that whole statistical sampling method in order to come up with a system that's fair, and I can't tell you today what that would be. We would have to talk to our statistician and pay him money. And so my short message is, it's going to have a fiscal impact on our agency to go through that process of redoing the statistical sampling process.
Questions? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Unlike others, perhaps, I find statistics absolutely fascinating. And I find your presentation very interesting. So preface my question with that. I'm assuming that you assume that the balance of the signatures that you don't sample have the same properties as the sample that you take when you're determining whether or not the valid signatures in the sample would lead to an adequate number of signatures from the whole pool of signatures. Have I stated that correctly, and do you agree?
I think you have stated it correctly, and yes, I agree.
Okay. So under this other new system, if I can follow up, then this new this bill that would require verified signatures, you'd actually have to verify 1,500 signatures.
Yes, the current
out of whatever they turned in.
Correct. We'd have to determine whether or not they have 1,500 valid signatures out of the total number of signatures that they turned in. And my assumption, based on the description of what these A7 amendments do, is that we would have the counties keep verifying until we get to that golden number of 1,500, and then we could basically stop.
I got it. All right. So if I could, what you're really telling us is that you do twice as much work in this initial process than you did for verifying 90-some-odd thousand signatures using the statistical sampling method.
The counties would. They'd be asked to verify. Under a statutory scheme, they'd be asked to... the counties go through a lot of signatures now.
But you verified 800 signatures.
Right.
This would say you have to verify 1,500.
Up front before they get the right to a ballot title.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. I now understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Would it be necessary to go through the statistical gyrations to come up with your 1,500 signature? Couldn't you just submit 2,000? Couldn't the petitioners submit their 2,000 signatures and you verify that 1,500 are accurate and reliable without going through all of the other, I might use the word, gyrations of the statistical sampling?
Yes, Madam Chair, that's my assumption of what we would do. The question that it poses to us, if you want the chief petitioners to get credit for those 1,500 valid signatures, how that fits in with how we treat the rest of the pool of signatures that are handed in statistically. We have to figure that out, and I, as I said, I can't answer that. We don't have to go through any statistical gyrations in step one. It's how we would adjust the statistical gyrations in step two that are the question.
Okay. But I guess what it sounds to me, though, is that, say, if the number is 1,500, and the required verified signatures is 100,000. They wouldn't then, by rule, you would say now the verified signatures at the end is going to be 99 or 98,500?
We could. Maybe.
You've already got 1,500 of them. Why would you?
One thing that I've learned in dealing with our statistician is that sometimes those kinds of assumptions that seem logical don't end up being so logical. I could give you a lot of examples of that.
I guess the second piece, though, too, is, I mean, currently Senate Bill 102, is as it was sent over from the Senate, I mean, since it has that higher number, that higher threshold, is there any fiscal on?
No, because they don't require, as I recall, Senate Bill 102 didn't require that any of those signatures be verified. We've just determined whether or not they turned in, what was it, 10,000 signatures. Mm-hmm. We just counted, and we didn't go through a verification process. And if they had 10,000 signatures on signature sheets, that was enough to meet the threshold under that bill. And since we were not required to do any kind of verification, we just included those sheets in the total pool of sheets at the end of the process when we went through verification then.
And then finally, the concern is on whether they're verified or not. So if we removed the verification requirement on the initial 1,500 and just made it a certain signature level like Senate Bill 102A is,
yes,
then that wouldn't have the fiscal impact.
Yes.
Okay. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your questions were excellent. They raised another one for me. What's the lowest number in a sample of valid signatures that you've had lately?
Well, the two statutory amendments that I talked about from the last cycle, the 819 and the 781 valid signatures were enough to get those on the ballot, but those were derived at through a sampling process.
Right.
You know, that's different from full verification, which is what we would do in those initial 1,500 signatures.
A sneaky way of getting out of answering my question. Thank you. May I follow up? Thank you. What I'm really trying to find out is, if we had a law that said you take 10,000 signatures on pieces of paper and you don't care whether it's real, whether they're voters or not, you just take 10,000 signatures, what are the odds that we're, I mean, how many real signatures or real voters are we likely to get? And that led me to ask the question, what's the worst you've done in terms of that sampled valid signature group in recent past as you've verified signatures?
I see. I think you're asking me about validity rates.
Thank you. That is what I'm asking.
Okay. I have a chart of the validity rates from the last cycle, and they ranged anywhere from the low 60s to, I think there was one under 60, to somewhere in the mid 70%. But 70% of those signatures submitted were valid under our sampling process, and that was a high. Now, I think, though, that one thing I'd like to point out about your question that you asked earlier, which was, if we don't check, I think the inference of your question was that the people would have an incentive to just go out and get a bunch of bad signatures. Wow. Well, not really, because under that bill, those will get sampled later, and the more, you know, if you're careless, you're going to have bad numbers later. You have every bit the incentive under the bill that came out of the Senate to do as accurate a job as you can with those first 10,000 as you do with the rest, because you don't want to waste the effort of gathering those 10,000 signatures. You want good signatures in there as well, or it will drive down your validity rate and endanger whether or not you will make the ballot.
I got that.
That's a theory. Yes.
Well, the last question then is, if SB 102A were to pass as it's written, mm-hmm. without any amendments, then in effect what we've said is we want 10,000 signatures, of which we expect 6,600 of them will probably be voters, up to 7,000 plus, whatever those numbers were you were describing, if this group fits within the samples that we've seen in the past.
Right. That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? All right. Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. And members, that concludes the public testimony. We do have another set of amendments that will be coming our way on this, as well as, I think, just continuing the discussion, as several of those who testified had discussed. The whole objective today was to get the issue aired. We will be dealing with this soon, hopefully sooner than later. And you know, not one of these issues that we'll take up after the sign and die motion. We'll actually do it beforehand. So if you have any additional input, let me know, and we will go from there.
Well, one thing I'd say, Mr. Chair, is that I suspect I agree that with the idea that we ought to do it sooner rather than later, but I suspect that sooner is probably a longer period of time than any of us would hope.
Right. With that, we are adjourned.